Welcome to Yale Cancer Center Answers with Drs. Ed Chu and Ken Miller. I'm Bruce Barber. Dr. Chu is Deputy Director and Chief of Medical Oncology at Yale Cancer Center, and Dr. Miller is a medical oncologist specializing in pain and palliative care, and he also serves as the Director of the Connecticut Challenge Survivorship Clinic. If you'd like to join the discussion, you can contact the doctors directly. The address is canceranswers@yale.edu, and the phone number is 1-888-234-4YCC. This evening, Ken Miller's joined by Paul Sullivan, CEO of the Connecticut chapter of the Red Cross, and Dr. Edward Snyder, director of the Yale Blood Bank and Transfusion Service.
Paul, I want to start out with a fairly basic question. Why should people give blood?
We need people to give blood because, candidly, it saves or sustains lives. There are patients across Connecticut, across the country, who count on volunteer blood donors, people like you and I, to come out, do what is obviously a fundamentally altruistic act, and support other people, really almost pay it forward, so that people today can be helped, saved by the excellent hospitals and physicians we have in Connecticut. So it really is a basic and vital part of our healthcare system.
Do you have a sense of, or maybe you even know a number, but I mean, how many blood transfusions are given in Connecticut every year?
Every year in Connecticut, we send out about 165,000 red cells, another 25,000 what we call platelet dosages, and then probably another 50,000 plasma units. So if you think about it, you know, over the course of the year, we're helping through our donors' good acts, we're helping, you know, well over 300,000 people.
I have to say, which is a huge number, far more than I might have guessed personally.
Yeah, it's quite frankly, I think a lot of people don't quite appreciate just what an important and substantial operation blood banking is. And I say that from the standpoint that, you know, to collect those units and to get them out to patients across the state, you know, obviously there are a lot of dedicated volunteers and staff, obviously donors, but there's a pretty significant operation, again, partnering with the hospitals to make sure that that blood is ready when needed, because the other thing about our business that's challenging is it's unpredictable by nature.
Yeah, and from Yale New Haven Hospital, we use approximately 70,000 blood products a year. We transfuse somewhere between 7,000 and 7,500 people a year. So we require about 70 to 80 units of red cells a day, about 40 doses of platelets a day, and somewhere around 30 or 40 units of plasma a day. This is every day, because obviously the sick don't take a holiday. And weekends and holidays and summertime like we're having now, people have surgery, there's accidents, large amounts of blood are needed. Mm-hmm. And we rely very heavily on the Red Cross and the altruism of people in the state of Connecticut to donate blood to keep those supplies coming to save patients.
You know, by the way, I'll just share a personal story. My wife had acute leukemia about 9 years ago, and thankfully Joan as well. But, you know, I think about all those donors who we'll never meet who gave blood products, some of whom had to donate multiple times platelets. And what a wonderful thing it is to give blood.
Yeah, no, it's we constantly try to figure out ways to share information back and forth between patients and donors, obviously protecting privacy. But, you know, the reason we want to share it is because the stories are quite frankly incredible. And the way it hits home to people is obviously very profound when they think about the fact that obviously someone took a couple hours out of their day, either at work or on a vacation, holiday, weekend, and that really makes a difference in someone getting the care they need. And what I think sometimes we don't convey enough, or what I'm always trying to convey, is that just as Dr. Snyder said, you know, we need that 7 days a week. And some of our products literally have a five-day shelf life. Mm-hmm. Our platelets have a five-day shelf life. And so you think about it, you know, it's not something that we can let ourselves as a community, as individuals, say, hey, I'm going to do that next week. I'm going to do that next month. And I think that's what Dr. Snyder is getting at, is in the summertime, you know, understandably, people want to be with their families, want to do other things, and God bless them, obviously they should, but we need them to squeeze in a little bit of time to do this because places like Yale and other hospitals all across the state are giving great care to people, and those people don't know when they're going to need it, but when they need it, you know, absolutely, we want to make sure it's there for them.
Yeah, and actually, going back to 9/11, after that horrible event occurred, hundreds of thousands of people donated blood in an attempt to do something for the victims. And it turned out that if 100,000 people donated blood on a given day, 5 days later, all of those platelets had to be thrown out if they weren't transfused because the shelf life was 5 days. So rather than people coming in motivated by a tragic and horrific event, it would be better for someone to come in two or three times or at least once or twice a year and spread out the donation so that you had enough blood all the time.
So I want to ask you about, what are the things that concern people who think about being a donor? What are some of the things that they tell you? Geez, I'd like to donate blood, but...
It's a range of issues, and all the things are very understandable. Blood donation is simple. It's easy. It is important, so it shouldn't be taken lightly. But, people get nervous about needles. Mm-hmm. The good news is, obviously, we take the unit of blood from essentially your inner elbow, which is an area where it has very few veins. So while it may be, a little bit intimidating, it actually literally is a pinprick in terms of what you feel. People obviously are concerned about, the mini physical we do. And that's one of those interesting things that actually those mini physicals, aside from making sure the blood is health, safe, if you will, for a patient, mini physicals actually are a great public health, thing for the state of Connecticut, for the country, in the sense that, it is important to regularly know your blood pressure. It is important to know your pulse, your temperature, your hemoglobin, hematocrit, because those are indicators of wellness. So I guess what I'm just trying to get to is people get nervous about going through the mini physical, just like they get nervous going to the doctor. But just like going to the doctor, there's actually a benefit to you aside from just making sure that, the blood's going to be available for a patient.
And, there is an aspect to, I think, people now realize that the world is a much smaller place. Everyone is, in essence, responsible for their fellow human. And donating blood is not something that would be nice to do if you have nothing else to do. It's almost a responsibility. The somewhat trite phrase, now it takes a village, really is true. And yes, putting a needle in your arm may be a little uncomfortable, but compared to some other things that that people feel the need to do, donating blood is something that is such an altruistic act and is really you never know when you're going to need blood as well. And a lot of people sign up for blood drives for someone who they know because they personalize it and say, well, gee, I knew this young man who developed leukemia. And I want to donate for him. But there are lots and lots of people every day that come through the portals at Yale who don't have people who can set blood drives for them, and they rely on us having blood for them. And that's why the simple act of donating blood is critical. And as Paul mentioned, the blood is divided. There are basically four parts to blood. There's the red blood cells, which carry oxygen. There are platelets, which are little tiny fragments of cells that are important in blood clotting. And there's plasma, which is the part of the blood that contains various chemicals and proteins that you need for good blood clotting and other types of functions. There's also white cells, which are not so much needed for regular transfusion, but are useful for people who may need white cells for other reasons related to transplants and so forth.
All right, let me ask you, a truth or myth? If someone says to you, I don't want to get blood because I could get hepatitis from giving blood or I could get HIV.
Well, that was a problem during the AIDS scare years ago. And I think to some degree it's going to be with us for the rest of our professional careers. People thought that you could get blood by get AIDS rather by donating blood or hepatitis by donating blood. And that is an absolute myth. Every blood bag is completely sterile. It is one use and is thrown out if it's not successful. We don't reuse bags. We don't reuse needles. And I think people are much more sophisticated today. And personally, I think it's not the fear of getting AIDS or hepatitis from donating blood. I think it's the fear of needles that keep most people away. And it's under the guise of, well, it's inconvenient, I don't have time. You come up with a million excuses. If it was something like having dinner or eating ice cream, you would find the time. And the idea that the needle is something to get through, personally, I think, is just something people need to realize. It's relatively minimal. It is a little more than just a mosquito bite or a pinprick, but it's certainly a lot less difficult than going to the dentist, to having the dentist put Novocaine or drill. And some people don't like to go to the dentist, but you need to do what you need to do.
But yeah, and I think there's somewhat of a people. We need to demystify blood drives for those who haven't given. There's obviously a number of folks who come regularly. They've done it. They know how to do it, if you will, and it's awfully easy. And then they also know at the end of it they will feel great. They will feel great because they will just have kind of the psychic reward of knowing that I have contributed to my community. I will have likely either sustained or saved the lives of one, two, maybe three people. And so The part that people just need to kind of get over is, hey, look, you know, it's a straightforward, easy process. The Red Cross is waiting to take you. We're eager to have you come, and we want to make it a friendly, positive environment. And then at the end, the most important thing is you really have that kind of moment of self-actualization where you say, gosh, you know, I really made a difference. And yep, just in the case of your wife or other folks who receive blood, you know, they don't know who that person was, but, you know, there is someone a few days later or a couple weeks later, depending on the product, who are literally sitting there, or their family is sitting there saying, you know, thank you so much, you know, and that's a pretty powerful thought.
And you, in the radio and television, you see advertisements of various hospitals talking about bloodless surgery. And most of the surgery that's done at Yale is bloodless, but there are some surgeries where blood is required, and those are often at the major hospitals, so-called tertiary care hospitals, where people can be flown in by helicopter, brought in by ambulance, where they have either had a major accident or a problem where blood is required. And although we use the least amount of blood possible, and the indications for transfusion of all types of products, plasma or platelets or red cells, are always being redefined, there still is a great need. And despite our desire to use the least blood possible, as more and more people are having more and more complicated surgeries thanks to major advances in medical care, whereas people who could not be saved years ago are now being saved routinely because of major advances in trauma surgery and resuscitation and the ability to handle people at an accident site and bring them into the hospital where they can be saved. And to see those families reunited and know that blood transfusion played a role in the salvage of that family member, the father, a child, a mother, a sister, a brother, a daughter, is an excellent feeling. And helping your fellow person is there's no other feeling like it that you get when you donate blood.
I want to ask you about I would refer to it as TLC, tender loving care. What is the process? I mean, after the donor comes and puts his arm out or her arm out and the unit is drawn, what happens then?
Well, essentially, when you come to a blood drive, there are a couple of different stages. What I mentioned earlier in terms of you go through a mini physical, making sure that, you know, it's safe for you to give and safe for the person to receive it. There's the actual phlebotomy, which takes, you know, 10 to 15 minutes, which is the drawing of the unit. And then we do ask people to stay for TLC time, if you want to call it that, or just sitting for some, you know, juice, make sure you're feeling hydrated and well. And also, you know, in many instances, just to sit and talk to your neighbors, other community members, you know, again, not to play on it too much, but, you know, it is kind of fun at a blood drive. When people are done, we see actually people, you know, feel very strongly that they need to hurry through the process to give blood, and we understand that. We're all rushed and we're all harried, and time is precious. But it is interesting. We'll see people sit for quite a while in our canteen, we call it, you know, talking about what they've just done or getting to know their neighbor, because, you know, actually it's a, you know, almost by definition, only good people congregate in a blood drive, you know, mm-hmm. because once you're there, obviously, I think you've joined the ranks of people who are interesting and caring. So, yeah, so we do ask people to stay for another 15 minutes, and some stay longer at the end of a blood drive.
Ed, let me ask you, after, you know, the donor's gone home, that unit of blood then travels. It goes somewhere. What is the process for the unit of blood? What happens?
Well, the unit of blood is processed at the blood center, and as I mentioned, it's divided into different components. The red blood cells and the platelets, the red blood cells for carrying oxygen, the platelets for helping with blood clotting, and the plasma, which also help with blood clotting, have different storage requirements. The red blood cells need to be stored in a refrigerator at a specific temperature of 1 to 6 degrees centigrade. Platelets need to be stored at room temperature on a little shaker at 20 to 24 degrees. And plasma needs to be frozen at minus 30 degrees. So you just can't take one unit of blood and expect to put it on a shelf and have it serve all the purposes, because we're much more sophisticated knowing what each component is needed for. If a person has a low platelet count because they have cancer and they've been given chemotherapy and the platelets which help their blood clot have dropped, but the red blood count is normal, they do not need a whole unit of whole blood just to get the platelets. You'd rather take the platelets out of that unit of whole blood. Then you have the red cells left over in the plasma that can go to other people that may need those specific components. And that concept is called component therapy. So that's done at the blood center. And then we make a request of the Red Cross each day of how much blood we need to put on the shelf at Yale New Haven Hospital. And that is provided by the Red Cross by courier.
Terrific. Well, we'd like to remind you to email your questions to canceranswers@yale.edu. We're going to take a short break for a medical minute, and then please stay tuned to learn more about blood donation with Paul Sullivan and Dr. Edward Schneider.
Here in Connecticut, the American Cancer Society estimates that almost 1,000 people will be diagnosed with colorectal cancer every month. The good news is that when you detect it early, colorectal cancer is easily treated and highly curable. That means that if you're over the age of 50, you should have regular colonoscopies to screen for this disease. In the case of patients that develop colorectal cancer, there are more options than ever before thanks to increased access to advanced therapies and specialized care. Clinical trials are currently underway at federally designated comprehensive cancer centers, like the one at Yale, to test innovative new treatments for colorectal cancer. Patients enrolled in these trials are given access to medicines not yet approved by the Food and Drug Administration. This has been a Medical Minute, and you'll find more information at yalecancercenter.org. You're listening to the WNPR Health Forum from Connecticut Public Radio.
Welcome back to Yale Cancer Center Answers. This is Dr. Ken Miller, and I'm here with Paul Sullivan from the Connecticut chapter of the American Red Cross and Dr. Ed Snyder from the Yale Cancer Center. Well, I want to go on to a related but different topic. You know, for people that need a blood transfusion, I mean, one of the things they think to themselves is it safe? What's going to happen? So what do you do? So here's a question. Is the blood supply safe, and how do you assure that?
Well, we work actually very hard to ensure that it is safe, and it is actually very safe. We do a number of things. As Dr. Schneider mentioned, we bring the blood back, obviously, from the blood drives all across the state of Connecticut to Farmington. We then take those tubes, test tubes, that we take out the blood drive as well, and we send them down to Philadelphia. We have people running those down twice a day, every day. And we get those tested for a number of viruses, other markers that might indicate that the blood is not safe to transfuse. And so, as we learn more about potential risks, we identify them and work hard to identify tests to protect against them. So we've recently added West Nile testing, Chagas testing, obviously HIV, HCV. So you know, while there is, as Dr. Snyder said, you know, it's never a trivial event to be transfused. We have done, you know, everything that we can to make sure that that blood product is safe. And obviously when someone needs it, they need it. And there's actually now a very little, almost infinitesimally small risk of getting transfused with a known virus. Now, that said, obviously people take it very seriously to be transfused. And so they only get it when they absolutely need it because, you know, there are other risks. You know, obviously someone who's receiving a transfusion, whether it be bacteria in the blood or other issues that we can't identify, you know, obviously that's avoided when possible. But again, you know, I think there's two sides of it. One is the issue of the blood safety, and two is the fact, though, that, you know, if you think about the fact that we're often short blood products and it's, you know, it's used only sparingly, but yet we still see demand grow, it just, again, to me, reinforces just how vital that product is to the patient who receives it.
Yeah, and to have the concept, well, someone else will donate and I don't need to, really just doesn't work in the dynamic. The blood that is needed, as we mentioned, constantly. The blood, as mentioned, is tested for 8 or 9 different tests to ensure that it's as safe as possible. Yet we are still making research efforts to try to come up with a blood that would not necessarily could be grown in a laboratory. People are probably saying, well, with all the medical marvels, you can put a satellite on Mars. Why can't we come up with blood that they make in a factory? Well, we're trying to do that, but the biology of it is quite complex, and the more sophisticated we become, the more we realize how much more we have to do. So it still comes down to a person who's concerned and cares about their fellow man and woman and child to come into a blood drive and roll up their sleeve and donate the gift of life. And as trite and as hackneyed as that may sound, it comes down to that. And anyone who's needed a unit of blood expects that it will be there. And the only way it happens if one person decides to take responsibility for another. All the science and all the technology is notwithstanding, we still need people to donate for other people.
Yeah, it's true. The other thing I was just going to mention in terms of blood safety is, you know, there's the tests, obviously, that we have, which are, you know, exceptional in their sophistication and accuracy. But we also rely on the questions I mentioned earlier. And some of those are personal, a little bit invasive, but they're important. And the reason we ask people where they've traveled or so on is because we're looking for correlations to diseases we can't test for. Malaria, for example. Mm-hmm. Obviously, a very low incident rate for the average traveler, even to a place endemic for malaria. But we still ask the question, and we still ask people not to donate when they've been in those areas, simply because if we don't have a good test for something, we want to try to, again, avoid there being any chance that it gets in the blood supply.
And a question for you about apheresis. I mean, that's a that's a term that we use. What does that mean, and how does it? And how does a what would that donation be like?
Well, apheresis is a term. It's actually a Greek term meaning to remove, and it basically the concept is instead of taking one unit of blood from a person with a needle in the arm and a blood bag, you actually have a person go on a machine, which is somewhat like a cream separator, although I will admit I tell this all the time and I've never ever seen a cream separator, but I'm sure they must look like this. It's basically a centrifuge. It's a device that spins. So blood comes into the machine spins the blood into red cells, platelets, and plasma the way the Red Cross would process a single unit of blood. But the machine is able to remove only that part of the blood that is specifically being needed. So if someone is donating platelets, they donate whole blood, obviously, in one arm. The machine processes the blood while the patient is sitting there to take the platelets off and return to the patient or the normal volunteer donor, not a patient, the plasma and the red cells that are not needed. If someone is donating red blood cells, then the machine would keep the red blood cells and donate back to the normal volunteer the platelets and the plasma. And there are various permutations and combinations, a unit of red cells, a unit of platelets, that can be taken because, quite frankly, since about 3 or 4% of the population donate blood for everybody, we're always in need of blood. So if you can take safely, and that's been a very big issue, safely donate 2 units of red blood cells at one time or a unit of red cells and platelets, the machines can do that. They're monitored. They're all licensed by the FDA, and we do research on that at Yale as well. This is a way of extending the ability of one person to donate more than just 1 unit of blood, which has been actually quite helpful. There's a certain banking part of blood banking where you have to have inventory management, and that's where we work so closely with the Red Cross to make sure that every unit of blood that's given by a person is used to the best possible way to help save lives.
Yeah, it really is. I mean, it's one of the things that we've been very focused on at the Red Cross for the last few years, and we do have, you know, obviously very concerned hospital partners in terms of how we steward those products. And it is remarkable, quite frankly, if you think about the fact that we have a random presentations of donors pretty much every day. You know, we don't know exactly who's coming, what their blood type is, et cetera. And we have a random presentations of patients on the other side. We work very hard, literally day and night. We have team members driving blood back and forth, bringing it to hospitals, calling the hospitals, asking them what they have on their shelves, what they don't have, what they need, what they can share with other hospitals. Because we are, you know, constantly, both on a local and national basis, reallocating that blood product, those blood products, to make sure that we have it where it's needed, when it's needed. And the thing is, for Connecticut, you know, people, I sometimes get the question as well, will my blood stay in Connecticut? Well, the answer in Connecticut is your blood is almost certainly going to stay in Connecticut. And the reason that is, and why I'm so certain of that is because we're actually a net importer of blood. And what that means is Connecticut doesn't supply enough blood products to support its own hospitals right now. As I mentioned earlier, we ship out to hospitals 165,000, you know, and it's growing red cells each year, but we only collect about 155,000 red cells each year. And so if you think about it, we obviously have a gap to close. And again, the only way is, as we keep talking about, is to have people call 1-800-GIVE-LIFE, make an appointment and come in. Because, you know, quite frankly, we are being supported, buoyed by the good people of the Midwest and the good people of upstate New York, whom regularly send us blood products.
And people should realize that the donor base is very heavily dependent on large industry, because you used to be able to go to Pratt Whitney, for example, in North Haven and have a blood drive there daily for a week. When Pratt Whitney closed in North Haven and moved, when IBM shut down, when Electric Boat downsizes, when there's industry changes or leaves the state, large numbers of donors leave as well. So the economic downturn that many states in the Northeast are suffering has a direct impact on the ability of and availability of blood. You can't get as much blood. It's not as efficient, again, getting to the banking aspect, to go to churches or schools and have 5 or 6 or 8 people donate blood when that same effort could have been used at a large factory to get large numbers. Yeah. That having been said, it's critical that people realize that any donation, even at small drives, is critical. It's all added together, and the Red Cross has had to change many of their tactics in order to take advantage of that.
Well, that's what I was going to say. I would say we still want people to come to the churches and the schools, and that, because we are, we jokingly say that we're every place, or in everyone's face, every place. And it really does take that kind of, I think, guerrilla marketing mentality some days to get enough donors to come out. And you're right. I mean, we absolutely, it was to a degree an easier process when we had large manufacturing operations in Connecticut. You know what? But those days are gone in many instances. We obviously still have some, and they are great supporters of us. But what we really need is people just to get into the habit and the ethic of, on a 56-day basis, coming in and giving blood. And
I would encourage anyone out there who owns a factory or any kind of small light industry to please contact the Red Cross. I'm sure they would be...
Yeah, call 1-800-GIVE-LIFE. We need more sponsors
as
well.
I have to share with you, after listening today, I have to say I'm feeling pumped up about it, both in terms of I've donated, but donating again. But also, I think you've made it really clear to everyone just how important it is. I don't think we want to be an importer anymore. I think we want to be on a sustainable.
Well, actually, the Red Cross has undergone a variety of changes at the national level. And one of the concerns was whether the Red Cross in Connecticut was actually going to be here, because they consolidate the same way industry does. To Paul Sullivan's credit and the National Red Cross, we were able to make a case to keep the Red Cross in Connecticut. We wanted the blood to stay in the state, a certain degree of pride and chauvinism, if you will, and the Red Cross understood that basically as big as things are, that the Connecticut area is still a small community, and we wanted community blood to stay here. And we are doing whatever we can to ensure that this was a good move, both economically and financially. Many of the listeners out there are quite sophisticated, and I think they would understand that a downturn in the economy or needs to consolidate have an impact on blood. It's not just rolling up your sleeve and throwing rose petals at everyone, but it's an obligation, and it takes a lot of work behind the scenes. I think Paul has been at the Red Cross about 3 years, and he's done a superb job in increasing the safety of the blood supply and the availability of the blood supply, which has a direct effect on saving children's lives and people who need blood whenever they need it.
I want to ask you for, and we're getting close to the end of the show, but just some clinical scenarios. I mean, who right now in the hospital may be needing a blood transfusion at Yale?
Well, as we speak, we have about 40% of the 70,000 units we use a year go to cancer patients. So people come to the clinic, and the Smilow Cancer Hospital, Yale Haven Smilow Cancer Hospital, is being built. It will be make available the opportunity for people not to have to go to New York or to Boston to get treated for cancer. It expands the ability for people to have treatment right here. And the partnership with the Red Cross is critical. So cancer patients are getting blood, about 40%. The other 30 or 40% are people having vascular surgery for heart disease and other types of vascular problems.
And then obviously acute emergencies, people
Absolutely.
Get transfused as well.
Automobile accidents. Yes.
Yeah.
Well, I'd say, honestly, it was a wonderful session. I want to thank Paul Sullivan and Dr. Ed Snyder for joining me. And really teaching, I think, myself and everyone else quite a bit about being a blood donor. Until next week, this is Dr. Ken Miller from the Yale Cancer Center wishing you a safe and healthy week.
If you have questions, comments, or would like to subscribe to our podcast, go to yalecancercenter.org, where you'll also find transcripts of past broadcasts in written form. Next week, I'll talk with Dr. Ken Miller about his new book, Choices in Breast Cancer Treatment. Medical specialists and cancer survivors tell you what you need to know. I'm Bruce Barber, and you're listening to the WNPR Health Forum from Connecticut Public Radio.